Welcome to the Sum of It All Cultivating Mathematical Hearts podcast. I'm Audrey Mendeville, along with my colleague Mark Alcorn from the San Diego County Office of Education. And this season, we're diving into the book Cultivating Mathematical Hearts, Culturally Responsive Mathematics Teaching in Elementary Classrooms by Maria del Rosario Zavala and Julia Maria Aguirre. Transcripts to our podcasts are always available for you in the episode notes on your favorite platform. This week, we're diving into Chapter 2, which is called Unpacking Culturally Responsive Mathematics Teaching, Retooling Your Pedagogy. And the chapter opens with a lovely example about Simon that I'm just going to take our 20 seconds to read. I think it's worth it, and we can chat about it. Is that okay with you, Mark?
Yeah, that's a perfect idea.
All right, here's what it says. Simon is 9 years old. Every Saturday, he accompanies his father to work restocking vending machines in various buildings in the downtown area. While his father restocks, Simon removes the money from the machine. There are always different kinds of coins, quarters, nickels, and dimes. Bills too, but mostly coins. Simon rolls the coins in special paper marked $10 quarters, $5 dimes, and $2 nickels. Bills are put into an envelope. Simon writes down the total amounts for each machine in a bank book. When the day is complete, they head to the bank and deposit the money. And then the authors ask us to pause and reflect. How could you use this information to teach children math? And maybe in particular, how could you use this information to teach math to Simon? What was your thinking, Mark?
Well, Audrey, when I was reading that vignette, as I was reading the chapter, I'm thinking in my mind, wow, all these money connections, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, oh, I know where the authors are going to go. There's going to be all these possibilities of how I could calculate the change or calculate how much money they had made per day or something like that. So I'm thinking it's going to mainly focus on money. And I'm wondering if our listeners thought the same thing.
I was in the exact same space. I had like all these ideas around money. And, you know, when they finally shared their examples, I'm just going to say I was astounded at how much my imagination has been limited by all the previous math problems, math word problems I've ever encountered. Because sure. I think if this had shown up in a textbook, if this had shown up in a curriculum, I would have bet money that the problem would be about money, right?
About money.
But here's what they suggested instead. They were like, what about optimizing routes? What about predicting results over time? What about proportions? What about some of these things are combinatorics, like how many combinations can you make? All of this stuff would have been rigorous enough for high school students to do, middle school students to do. It was not about just counting change. It was like transportation routes. How many snacks do you think are still there? What proportion of sweet to non-sweet? Like, there were so many other questions, and none of them had anything to do with the amount of money he collected.
Yeah, I know for sure, Audrey. There was even one around like the position of the snacks in the machine. I was just like, what? What a clever thing to think about. So, like, I mean, Audrey, I have to admit, when we search out these kinds of authentic contexts, I think, and this is just a thought I have, Audrey, is that maybe sometimes we're so happy that we finally find something that has some real life connection to students that I think sometimes that limits our creativity about the type of problem solving that could be activated with the problem, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, our authors reference Dr. Rochelle Gutierrez with the concept that as teachers, we are identity workers. Just such a great thing to think about, right? And our mathematics curriculum, the authors mention, is a mirror and a lens. So I really want to keep that in mind as we read the book, Audrey.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Mark. So this chapter is a lot about the culturally responsive mathematics teaching tool, or as they like to abbreviate, CRMT2. And they've developed this in terms of a way to streamline the process of attending to, as they say, the strengths and complexities of children's, families, interactions, and systems that can shape math teaching and learning in your classroom. And it has three strands that they kind of give a preview of in this chapter, and then they tell us they're going to go more in depth in other chapters. But I think it's worth us like kind of starting to like understand what these are about, making sense of them. And if you're listening along and then you have particular strands that are interesting to you, that might be the order that you go and dive into the book in. But the three strands are knowledge and identities, which is what you just we're kind of starting to preview with the quote from Dr. Rochelle Gutierrez, rigor and support, and then power and participation.
Yeah, I think that, you know, Audrey, when I was first reading about this design tool, you know, it really made me think of universal design for learning. And the reason it did is, you know, this idea of a design tool that can make me think of something in advance of stepping in front of my students, something that I might consider at the planning stage as I'm thinking about what my task might be and how I might implement it. I started making some connections to that. So I think it'd be really exciting to see how like this might work in concert with universal design for learning as a planning tool.
I think that's a great point. I definitely, the idea of attending to students' identities and needs, the idea of focusing on students who have been marginalized or are at the margins, the three strands, there's a lot of similarities. So I'm interested to see where this is going. So to dive in, let's tackle strand number one, knowledge and identities. What stood out to you in this strand, kind of the preview that they gave us?
Yeah, well, in one of the categories of this strand, you know, because as you mentioned, Audrey, there's multiple categories in each strand. And there's one that's called rehumanizing mathematics. And this dimension focuses on cultivating children's innate creativity and curiosity. And that's straight from the text. So, you know, what I was thinking about with that, Audrey, is like when we broaden our context for students to explore, when they do that in mathematics, that gives them more space for them to be creative because there's more room in that context. It's a much richer context. It's hard to be creative with a very closed-ended story problem that just really doesn't have any space in it, right?
For sure. So yeah, the words joy, curiosity, and creativity definitely stood out to me. And I appreciate that, Mark, that tie to saying like the things we put in front of our students are either going to broaden that or not, right? Sure. And you know, I think this idea of broadening what counts as mathematical knowledge, how they describe that, reminds me a lot about our season. I think it's a couple seasons ago now, about Bad at Math. Maybe it was our last season. Time flies. And talking about, you know, if we really believe that math is just numeracy and algebraic thinking, it isn't very creative. But math, when you talk to mathematicians, goes far beyond that. There are so many more spaces that math involves, and many of them have to do with things that feel very philosophical and feel very artistic and feel very nuanced and creative. So I appreciate that. I also felt really convicted by the very, very short quote that says, curiosity is set aside in favor of efficiency. And I think that's part of how our system is put together in the United States about, you know, we have all of these children that we are moving through a very systematized educational space, and we are about efficiency. How quickly can we move them from point A to point B and get in their brains all the things we need to get in their brains? And we set it aside. And I think, you know, we all can see it. We can see the curiosity in our TK and our kindergarten students. And we walk into our 9th, 10th, and 11th grade classes, and there's no longer curiosity. And that's because we have told students that efficiency matters so much more, and that's what they ask for in math class. They say, well, teach me the way that's efficient. I'm going to do it your way because that's the best way, teacher, as opposed to thinking like, but wouldn't it be more interesting to discover something and find the beauty and the joy and be curious? So super interested about that. One of the things that stood out for me in this strand, though, to kind of change gears slightly, is in the student thinking section. And they talked about how learning math is not a linear process. And I probably have some secondary teachers who are probably ready to fight me on those words. And just thinking about what does that then imply for our way of teaching math? So I think it, you know, there's lots going on in our new framework, our revised framework in California for mathematics around big ideas and multiple representations. Did it give you any other like connections when they talked about math is learning math is not a linear process?
Yeah. And, you know, just even the category heading, Audrey, it's the way our authors phrase it is just so wonderful. It's honoring student thinking and ideas, that word honor in the front of it. And that took me right to the idea of cognitively guided instruction, or CGI. They even mentioned they mentioned Carpenter here in the paragraph. And so I just think it's really really a great approach to make a connection to, because in CGI, the idea is that we're honoring students that they can make meaning themselves about mathematics. And I think that that's something that is certainly something that is part of the honoring process, is that we're going to trust the fact that our students are brilliant and in the right conditions and in the right environment, they can make some incredible mathematical connections. And the other section in that in this same strand, Audrey, in strand one, is called revisiting the vignette. And you know, as they revisit that vignette that we started our episode with today, the authors mention how students might begin with mathematizing the world routine. In other words, like that vignette with the vending machines, with students being able to just consider this idea of what goes into the running of a vending machine and the vending machine itself and the complexity of it, using a notice and wonder type of an introduction with that. I really love that the author's taking us back to that vignette and mentioning that, because what could happen is this could expose some of the more complex questions that kids may have about the workings of a vending machine. I can just picture this happening in an elementary classroom. And that's going to build that curiosity amongst students. And as they share those ideas publicly in the classroom, that's going to generate more ideas and more curiosity. So I think that when we allow our students to do that, and especially allow the privilege of our most vulnerable students to be able to engage in this type of thinking, we're sending them the message that we believe they can do complex thinking, rather than we're saying to them, maybe the work is too hard for you. Takes me back to our Street Data season, where in that book, just that wonderful passage that the authors of Street Data take us through, where they say to us, maybe the problem isn't that the work is too hard, maybe the work is too easy that we're giving our students. It's in a sense disrespecting them that they're not able to have bring this critical thinking to bear. So I just love the idea of unearthing the complex questions that surround Simon's experience and send the message to our students that they are capable of asking and answering complicated questions, and also providing something that actually matters to them. I think when you when as a human, when you ask a question that you're genuinely curious about, there's just something different that happens in your brain in terms of pursuing that. So I'm just still enjoying this idea of the vending machine example, Audrey, and I'm just glad they brought it back for us to rethink it a bit more.
I really appreciate that, Mark. I feel like you've just shown really thoughtfully how those different dimensions that the authors kind of delineate are woven together to make this strand. So if you're reading along, I think you're going to be able to see that they're very interconnected ideas, and that's part of what the authors describe in this within the strand, is that these ideas kind of interweave together. And I think you've done a great job of sharing that. Thanks for that. Strand two is rigor and support. And they start off right away with talking about sustaining high cognitive demand. And they mention one of our favorite resources to use from Smith and Stein, the levels of cognitive demand, which we use often to like talk about math tasks. Smith and Stein have it broken into four categories, with memorization and procedures without connections, and then procedures with connections. And finally, my favorite category, which is just called doing math.
This is such a great tool. If our listeners are not aware of the Smith and Stein levels of cognitive demand for tasks, I really recommend it to you all. It's just such a great tool to examine the cognitive demand of tasks. And it's helpful to make sure that we are offering respectful challenge to each and every one of our students by allowing them the access and the opportunity to do mathematics, as you mentioned. You know, the last line in this section really speaks to me. And what our authors say is, the more you practice engaging complex tasks, the better you become. I think that we're guilty of saying that we are preparing students, you know, we're going to get you ready so someday you can do those complex tasks. But right now, you're not ready for those yet. And so what we do is we give students low level, seemingly from their seats, meaningless mathematics to do it with some very high degree of competence that they need to do the low level work. And then someday we'll let them have this idea of complex, interesting work. So the thing about that, Audrey, maybe we just have to reclaim the word basics. Like when we say, let's get back to the basics, what about the basics and the axis of thinking about complicated questions? So that, as the quote says, our students will become better at these type of tasks because they will actually be doing complex thinking rather than we're going to have them do low-level thinking, just pretending to ourselves that somehow that's going to make you more prepared to do complex thinking.
Those are great points, Mark. And you know what you're making me think of in this moment is the math. Is it called The Mathematician's Lament? Oh man, Paul Lockhart. Yeah, like when he gives all the different analogies of like when you paint by number, that's not teaching you to be an artist. And when you learn the names of the notes, you're not actually creating music. And I think this is all intertwined together with like when you want students to be doing mathematics. You have to authentically give them opportunities to do mathematics at every level, at every level. So great points about that. There are other sections in this one as well. There's a one on scaffolding up to read more about in, you know, the future chapter that goes more in depth. It seems to have universal design for learning, but maybe some differences. So I'm looking forward to that in the future chapter.
Sounds great, Audrey. And Audrey, we have one last strand.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, we have strand number three, and an important one because it's called power and participation. I'll just take a quote real quick, Audrey, from page 23. This dimension promotes instructional strategies that affirm collaboration rather than competition. Well, just right away, Audrey, that reminds me of the book that we read together and with some of our colleagues, Zaretta Hammond's book, Culturally Responsive Teaching in the Brain, and that all that work around individualistic versus collectivist in terms of a mindset that we might take in terms of how we view students engaging and learning. And I just think that in mathematics, of all the content areas, we have just got an extra dose of this mistaken view that it should be this individualistic effort. And also, Audrey, in this section, one more thing I'd like to bring out is I'm just so glad to see our authors bring in what they call intellectual authority as something that needs to be addressed. I just really think shifting the idea of mathematical authority from adults, like residing in adults, such as our teachers and parents, shifting that authority to students is really one of the most important shifts we can make to empower our students as mathematicians. The how of this shift does not happen overnight because many times our students have had many years of that retreading of that authority where they believe they need to look to us, right? And the most popular question ends up being, am I right? As they finish their mathematics, right? Because that they don't have that internal authority. I've been using this as a focus in my work for a little while with educators. So that makes me especially excited, Audrey, to get into this book and like, wow, they're going to be diving into this distributing authority. And that's a passion of mine in my work. So I'm so ready to get some new ideas around that.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Mark. That is not something that is unique to elementary either. Like that is definitely a secondary teacher's experience with students as well. And so I think it's one I'm really interested in reading about. I know that it seems like there might be some ties there with the TRUE framework out of Berkeley. One of their five dimensions is around agency and authority. And so I always love when we see these connections to other powerful tools and we can say, okay, I see what's the same here and I see what the nuance is and how the nuance helps me to reconsider some of the things that we need to push ourselves on. So, like you said, looking forward to reading more. So the last part of this chapter talks a little bit about how to use the tool. So as you're looking forward, you know, you can look at the diagram on page 19 when you have the text or on the inside cover of the front cover to see these, you know, these three strands and the dimensions underneath. They mentioned that, you know, using it for teaching practices for reflection on that, like you could use it to reflect after a lesson. You could look back and say, how did these one of these strands or more than one of these strands, how did they show up or not show up in my lesson? You could use it in peer observation and feedback, or you can use them as to design or analyze or adapt curriculum and materials. So I think there's some breadth to how this tool might be used, and it's going to be interesting to see how they adapt it and use it in different scenarios throughout the text.
Yeah, I agree, Audrey. And, you know, here in California in the next couple of years, we're going to be having some new textbooks come out and be released. And, you know, I that one jumped out at me. Just such a good idea to take a new lens when we eventually start looking at textbook adoptions again. You know, our tools in the past have, in my opinion, been kind of superficial regarding equity. So I'm really looking forward to reading about how this tool could actually improve our work in that area.
Yeah, and this only gets me more excited to read more of the book. So I'm looking forward to the next chapters ahead.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thanks for joining us for this episode. In our next episode, we will chat about Chapter 3, Knowledges and Identities. Until then, best wishes in cultivating joy and justice in the mathematics classroom.